Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. Welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranja, and welcome to episode 207, where on this week's episode, I will be reviewing Disclosure Day, the latest film from Steven Spielberg, one of the most acclaimed pop culture relevant directors of all time, has a new movie about aliens. So of course I saw it. As this is a feature film review, there will be a non-spoiler section as well as a spoiler section. Time codes will be listed in the description. And then after the review, I'm going to be responding to my favorite pieces of movie or TV news of the week, and then ending the episode listening. I could be listening, I suppose, but also reading listener mail and question of the week responses. So I guess let's learn if there's any disclosure in Disclosure Day. Non-spoilers ahead.
What did you steal?
Secrets. The data they paid me to protect.
So, a little inside baseball for this episode of the podcast. If you've been following the trailer reactions that I put out on social media, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, I guess portions of them are sometimes on Twitter as well, I have reacted to this. I am a millennial who loves cinema, and of course I have seen probably everything Steven Spielberg has made outside of maybe The Duel and The Post. I just never got a chance to watch those or gave myself the time, really. I love Steven Spielberg, and when you're listening to this podcast, tomorrow, if you're listening to this on the day the episode is dropped, I will be giving my top five Steven Spielberg films. So make sure you're following the podcast on social media so you don't miss that. Steven Spielberg and Aliens is almost second nature to what the man has done with his filmography. Of course, there is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. There is E.T. the Extraterrestrial. There is even Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Now, I understand that those are technically extra-dimensional beings, but the only reason they called them that is so that Steven Spielberg would make the movie, as well as War of the Worlds. And now we have Disclosure Day, which is a very interesting movie to be doing now. Steven Spielberg is at the ripe age of 79, and having experienced so much of the real world, as well as the changing landscape of films, what has happened to the theatrical experience? One of the movies he made recently was Ready Player One, and then he followed that with his remake of West Side Story. Clearly, the man is still capable of making films that are just Spielberg magic. There's something about what he is capable of doing, drawing performances from incredible actors and creators, and anything that really has to do with making something special that just feels like a Steven Spielberg movie. Similar to how people talk about Denis Villeneuve or Christopher Nolan, there's something special about Steven Spielberg and what he has done throughout his illustrious career. Now, unfortunately, and the reason I started this by talking about my trailer reactions is I had not followed the overall development of this project, any announcements with who was going to be in it, until the trailers came out. It's hard to be aware of every single piece of movie news. So when I saw the trailer for this, Steven Spielberg, Aliens, Emily Blunt, Josh O'Connor, Colin Firth, Eve Hewson, Coleman Domingo, there's a lot of people in this. And then I saw that the script was written by David Koepp. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I have reviewed a recent film from David Koepp, which was Jurassic World Rebirth, and then he was involved with Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, but that was mostly changed by the time James Mangold got a hold of it. Of course, he worked on Jurassic Park. He also wrote the script for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I was not super excited about that. A lot of ideas that David Koepp has brought into the big blockbusters as of late have not thrilled me. They felt very derivative of a lot of things. And unfortunately, Disclosure Day has a lot of very interesting ideas. But because of the length of the film, it's not given any time to not even necessarily explore them. There's a hint at what this world is and the context for what it means to be talking about aliens in 2026. We live in a much different world than, say, the 50s and the 60s and even the 80s and the 90s. Society's exposure to aliens as a entertainment product have dramatically changed. You go all the way back to things like Independence Day, which was the countries uniting to fight against this threat. And it usually winds up being around that. Neil deGrasse Tyson had an excellent perspective that the reason we've always characterized extraterrestrials, for the most part, obviously Steven Spielberg with his own film, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, is not about E.T. being a threat. It's about how scary humanity is with the idea of something otherworldly. That the reason we always have aliens or extraterrestrials as threats towards human beings is that is how humanity throughout our entire history has reacted to anything remotely different. Look at any wars or how anybody reacts to anything being different. Look at what's going around now, geopolitically, society-wise. Things are always at extremes. Steven Spielberg coming in with a movie that talks about the idea of learning about aliens and what that means and how that drastically would change fundamentally everything we believe in. Obviously, that would touch on the ideas of religion. And there are so many different things in the movie that should be the focus. But what's really annoying is you have incredible performances. Emily Blunt and Josh O'Connor are great in the movie. The roller coaster that they are on as characters and their experience through the movie, the mystery around what is the secret, unveiling it to us as the audience, how people are interwoven into this story, is a way in which it's familiar and not in a way where I would say it's overall too predictable. There's an exploration of this secret knowledge, how it's hidden, how it's going to be unveiled, what is the tech? Because, of course, aliens coming to our planet would have to have technology that is eons ahead of what we've developed as a society. And the movie addresses the idea of how aliens have been involved with us as a society. It sort of addresses so many conspiracy theories that seem almost like a normal part of where we are in pop culture. And there have been countless movies about Roswell, New Mexico, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull touches on some of those ideas. But what's annoying is there are hints at what the movie could be about, but the overall focus really does seem to be on the idea of believing in humanity. There is an underlying part of the story that I'll get to in spoilers, which I think because there are so many ideas that nothing really gets any time to settle in what the movie is about. When you have so many things that you're trying to address all at once and you don't give the characters any real screen time to address certain things, it just winds up being this muddied bag. The movie is gripping, it's thrilling. When you have great performances, that really drives the story and you are enthralled with learning about the relationships that are happening in front of you. Learning what the connections are between Emily Blunt and Josh O'Connor are the main crux of the story. If you're not invested in those two people, this movie won't work for you. What's been funny is watching all of these trailers and how they've decided to market it, because having seen them myself, I didn't really know what this was going to be. Obviously, we know there's Disclosure Day. What is that? What is it going to be that is going to be disclosed? We learn bits and pieces and the conspiracy and the secrecy around it. But one of the elements that really did frustrate me with this film is the choice of the villain. And it feels as if the movie didn't want to take a real stance on what would be done to hide these secrets. In so many different stories about aliens or conspiracy theories being unveiled or leaked to the public, people die. There are quite literally dire circumstances in wanting people to not know certain secrets that the government has hidden from the general public. These things can't be known because they are going to change things forever. The movie is 2 hours and 25 minutes. That is a perfect length for a theatrical experience, but unfortunately, the way in which the movie chooses to focus the majority of its story is really on the journey of learning, and while learning about what is happening doesn't help us settle in on feeling like this is truly a believable world outside of the general public. Of course, regular people are going to be regular people, but one of the worst parts that feels so atypical to a Steven Spielberg movie is having a tangibility in which everything exists. It feels as if the window that we are witnessing this story is quite literally as the story is happening right now. If we were to look away, the story would continue. We are watching something in the midst of it. And there is an attempt to maintain that with this, but you do really feel like you only sort of miss the first 5 minutes. And then the whole journey happens and it ends. And that to me is really disappointing. I had conversations with people before seeing this that I was really hoping that, given everybody involved in this, that this was going to be another elevated Steven Spielberg film. We're in the sort of twilight of a lot of directors' careers, and that can be really hard because you are seeing filmmakers that you absolutely adore make films that just don't hit the same. And whether that's because you were a child when you saw a majority of them, or because you just have different taste, you've changed as an adult. Our perspective on art changes as we change. And going from Bridge of Spies, BFG, The Post, Ready Player One, those are not any of my favorite films of Steven Spielberg's. I did really enjoy West Side Story. That truly felt like Steven Spielberg grew up with this movie and had an idea of what it could be in his head the whole time. And The Fabelmans is obviously entirely about Steven Spielberg, who co-wrote that film. And funnily enough, he was involved in the story for this movie. And you can see what was the broad strokes of what would be a Steven Spielberg film. But in the minute details and the execution of that story, the places that David Koepp takes it just don't work for me. The movie's not bad. This is similar to what I'm going to be reviewing next week, which is it's the Pixar problem. When you have set a bar of expectation because of the length of quality that you have delivered time and time again, that, unfortunately, you are competing with yourself. And Disclosure Day, while certainly better than a number of films I have seen, nor will I see, you wind up with this muddied project that just is completely fine. And those movies can be interesting to talk about because, and I will get into this further in spoilers, you can see so much unrealized potential. That's frustrating. There are certain elements of this that work all the way through. Emily Blunt, Josh O'Connor, I really liked Colman Domingo. Colin Firth, I had issues with how that character is woven throughout the story. And, of course, John Williams. John Williams is maybe the most impactful composer in cinema history when you look at the iconography of all of the soundtracks that he has composed for film. And there's it feels like a warm blanket hearing notes, you know, have been composed by John Williams, somebody who should have way more Oscars than he does have. There's a lot that I can't talk about, and I feel as if I've addressed all of my non-spoilery thoughts, so I'm going to dive into spoilers now because there's a surprising amount to talk about. So you have been warned, we're going to dive into full spoilers for Disclosure Day.
If you found out we weren't alone, if someone showed you, proved it to you, would that frighten you?
The first place to start in spoilers is the main setting of the film that is, interestingly enough, not really a main part of the narrative, but would help in establishing where we sit in this world, which is World War III is on the brink. We're fighting with North Korea, amongst a bunch of other countries likely, but having humanity be watching that doomsday clock, I'm only reminded of something like Watchmen, where you are filled with tension because of knowing we are on the precipice of extinction. And when you are experiencing that, you are less likely to feel calm at all. The stress that you feel in every decision and sort of, but also the freedom of knowing it could end at any moment. That element of the story is woven in bits and pieces of the news within whenever we see any telecommunications, the news anchors, or Emily Blunt, who is a TV meteorologist. Josh O'Connor is the whistleblower of the film. He was somebody who was given this ability to be able to hear math. And the connection between him and Emily Blunt is explored throughout the film, understanding how they've been interwoven with what's gone on. But what's frustrating is you've got that connection, which is the heart of the film and the most interesting, that they've been given these abilities from the extraterrestrials in hope that this would help humanity in not becoming a nuclear holocaust planet, but would ultimately lead humanity to being the best that they are capable of. And of course, because humanity is humanity, as I said in non-spoilers, they usually wind up being the worst of ourselves. One of the main elements that did incredibly annoy me in this, and I mentioned this briefly and now I can in full spoilers, which is Colin Firth, whose character's name is Noah Scanlon, is the head of this company that has been contracted out by the US government to hide all of these secrets since the Roswell incident in 1947. This is a common occurrence that this event, which is maybe the most conspiracy-laden thing that has to do with extraterrestrials, is a spaceship crash-landed on Earth, thus informing humanity and those who are working within the element of the government that would be informed of this information, that we are not alone. And the idea on how that changes things, whether that be scientifically or faith-based, have always been a conversation about what it would mean to humanity as a species, not as one individual culture or specific religious belief, how that would change everything. And the movie teases those ideas, specifically with Josh O'Connor's love interest, played by Eve Hewson, who is a former, I guess it's she's like a junior nun, where you introduce this religious element. And unfortunately, it's annoying. I'm quite annoyed by this because one of the main conversations you could have in the film is somebody who is had such a substantial portion of their life be baked into this idea of faith, specifically Christianity. What does it mean that there are extraterrestrials, aliens exist? The concept of the Bible is that we are God's children. 7 days, all the creation stuff, but we are alone. We are created by the one and true God on earth in his image. The film teases these ideas in where we see Jane and a former sister, not, I guess she is a sister, when Josh, oh, I'm just going to use their names, but when Josh O'Connor and Eve are hiding from the not government organization, they wind up going to a church. And they are hiding there, but the conversation's not had in that moment. It's had later on when Jane is finally informed of this idea. And the sister declares that we're God's children on Earth, but that there's a hint of there are other people within the galaxy and the universe and all that stuff. And I get that Steven Spielberg probably doesn't want to have a morality conversation on what that necessarily could mean. But in a world today where we are so entrenched in belief versus facts, it is unfortunate that the film chooses to dodge that conversation, because that is an example of what's frustrating from a movie like this, which is there's a piece of something that could make for a very interesting movie. Somebody whose life is based in faith, learning we're not alone, and having to deal with evidence in front of her that completely shake up anybody's beliefs. The character is not that person, because she ultimately did not become a nun. She left and just became a regular person. We are teased with why things are the way they are. We've studied their technology and it's led us to where we are now. And Colin Firth's character believes that humanity would not be able to handle the idea that we are not alone. And so many of these things are just sort of there. He's a bad guy to be a bad guy. The movie only tells us that the reason he changed is when his wife died. Well, why? Why did he change when his wife died? What was he like before? You only give it to us in one piece of dialogue. We're led to believe that there was this massive work relationship between Coleman Domingo's character and Colin Firth's character. But you don't have enough, apparently 2 hours and 25 minutes is not enough time to dive into these things fully at all. All we get are these little tidbits. The best part of the movie, quite frankly, is the beginning. The sort of snowball of what everything that is happening. And I mentioned this in non-spoilers that we are watching these events as they happen and they've already started, which definitely helps it feel lived in. But because there's been this 79-year terror campaign, as you see in the trailer, this organization doesn't really feel entrenched into everyday life. Is this the only time this has happened? Has this been a well-oiled machine the entire time? Or is this the only ever leak of information? That we don't really know. We're just sort of making assumptions, which is Josh O'Connor's character, Daniel, was given, as I said already, the ability to sort of hear numbers and understand the alien language, which, like a lot of other, specifically, I would guess, Arrival, is based in math. Math is numbers, and numbers are universal. You don't need to be able to speak a specific language to understand math. Therefore, he was given that ability in order to communicate. That would help humanity converse with the extraterrestrials who have been visiting Earth. And I believe it is the same species of extraterrestrials that have been coming to Earth the entire time. But you would think, maybe, if they'd communicated that things have not been going well every single time you've landed on Earth, that maybe you should stop doing that. Regardless of that being true or not, Emily, at the same time as Daniel, was also abducted by the aliens and given the ability to truly connect emotionally to other human beings. This power was not accessible to her until a cardinal shows up. We're told, we're just sort of told everything as it happens when it needs to happen, that they hide as animals. So any of these animals that are looking at our main characters are aliens just watching them. So, okay, the movie tells you this, and are we supposed to assume what animals are aliens? Only the ones that happen to be staring all the time? Which then means that this company, Wardex, has let more aliens out into the wild, or are unaware that these aliens are out in the wild. You see a bit of this in the trailer, where we see what is young Emily Blunt walking with a couple animals to a glowing house, which in fact is just an illusion for the spaceship. These aliens also have, I'm just going to call them like magic thumb drives, which you hold in your hand, and they have different abilities. There's a sort of tiara of them that have given Josh O'Connor and Emily Blunt theirs, but the government has three of them, and one has gone missing. Coleman Domingo has that. Josh O'Connor has one, and then Colin Firth has one where you can essentially inhabit somebody's mind, and they use this to try to turncoat Eve Houston's character, Jane, who's Daniel's girlfriend. That scene's awesome because it's really when we feel Colin Firth is the most sinister as the main antagonist of the film, and he's fighting so hard throughout the entire movie to repress this information. But I mention this in non-spoilers. We have seen in other iterations of this story that you'll be killed for this information. You think that this is so important you're not willing to kill people? And it just feels as if everybody involved with this, and this is interesting, because for the most part, I feel like a lot of the people involved with this have been fairly politically public with their opinions, that you wouldn't want to paint the United States government negatively. It just felt incredibly odd. There's one instance where somebody sort of goes rogue and does attempt to kill them, but every other opportunity, it's just sort of gentle capture. We're not going to hurt anybody. We just sort of want to know so we can plug the leak. And that was odd. The Coleman Domingo spends most of the movie building a house, which you're not told why until he tells you. So much of this movie is just let me tell you why. We're not shown why he's building the house. He just tells us. So a lot of the movie is really, really that. And I hate being right and being hesitant. I do my absolute best to go into a film and be wowed. I want to love everything I see. Obviously, 207 episodes in with so many TV shows and so many movies, that's not always the case. I do my best to be pretty even keel going into it. The majority of the mistakes made in this movie are the script. There's too many things. This movie should have been whittled down to just keeping this a secret and a mysterious relationship between Emily Blunt and Josh O'Connor's characters. Those two characters together are fantastic. Emily and Josh's O'Connor's and Blunt's performances are the best part of the movie and the reason to watch the movie. Emily Blunt's sort of snowball of being able to telepathically connect with people on an emotional level, tell them information, and really connect in a way that is so personable because she's able to quite literally read their minds, is fascinating to see somebody who has been distant since the abduction and has hidden that even from her boyfriend. And Wyatt Russell is so funny because he gets to play the boyfriend and just be flabbergasted by everything that's happening in the movie. But the journey of those two characters coming together and learning about their history, those parts are great. But any real conversation on what this information means, why it's been kept secret, those things aren't really touched on. It's sort of just like, yeah, this is why. Except we're not really going to tell you. And I hate feeling that way watching a Steven Spielberg movie, to be wowed by the magic that this man has been capable of with four Indiana Jones films, multiple films about extraterrestrials. This is more in line with something like War of the Worlds. This isn't E.T. This isn't Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's just sort of a movie. And that it's not bad. It's just it's disappointing. Because it's Steven Spielberg, and the movie just ends after the actual quote-unquote disclosure day where the information is shared, and Margaret, Emily Blunt's character, says, listen, and the movie cuts to black. There is the theme of the idea of believing in people. It's there, but I don't think it's the thesis of the film explores that thoroughly enough for me. There's going to be people, as is clear on Rotten Tomatoes, that are absolutely blown away by this, and I commend them for having had that opportunity and those opinions. I would not rave about it. I wouldn't rant about it. It's just right down the middle, and I'm surprised I've been able to talk about the movie as long as I have, but that's pretty much it. Those are my full spoiler thoughts on Disclosure Day. If you saw it, let me know what you thought about it in the comments. Now let's get to my favorite movie and TV news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom!
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves. You might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Jermaine, I know you want me to talk about it, so I'm going to talk about it. We have no idea what's going on with The Batman Part 2. It has officially started filming. Matt Reeves shared that with audiences, showing the very first clapper on social media. I love this. I loved The Batman, and I cannot wait for The Batman Part 2. But there were a lot of rumors this week that seemed to be conflicting with a lot of the things we thought we knew before, which is that Brian Tyree Henry is in fact playing Harvey Dent, and that Sebastian Stan is playing Victor Zsasz, which then leads us to believe that Scarlett Johansson is not playing Gilda Dent, and Tywin Lannister is also not playing his dad. So we are in a whole different, we have never had an understanding of what this is going to mean. Of course, I'm talking about Charles Dance. People relax. But I think that's really interesting if that's the case. I don't question Matt Reeves until I have to. I loved Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I loved War for the Planet of the Apes. And I already said what I thought about The Batman. Anything that he does within this, I think is going to blow people away. Assumptions on any idea of what this movie could be are of course fun to have with the infinite possibilities. Batman is a character who has existed since 1939. Obviously, a lot of people, like myself, you come up with ideas based on only the information that we've been given, but I don't have any strong feeling saying that this doesn't work or why is this the case, because we do have no idea. Matt Reeves will tell us when he wants to tell us, but it would be interesting to see characters that you don't normally connect. Of course, Harvey Dent has been Black before. Billy Dee Williams was going to be Two-Face after his two appearances in Batman and Batman Returns, and then they corrected that with the Batman 89 comics. Victor Zsasz is a character who is very supporting, and it would be very abnormal to make what is normally, I wouldn't even say a secondary, a tertiary character, one of the main leads of the film. Sebastian Stan is somebody who I just don't see being a character that is a henchman at best. He was used effectively in Batman Begins, but Matt Reeves has said there's a lot of this that people have never seen before. And regardless of which story turns out to be the truth with who these people are playing, neither of these is things we haven't seen before. I can confirm that Gilda Dent and Christopher Dent have never been in a Batman movie before, because we've never had a faithful adaptation of The Long Halloween in live action. It was made into a two-part direct-to-video film very recently, but it has never been done in live action. So the exploration of Holiday as a killer fits in with the mystery, or Court of Owls. We know that this is going to be a mystery, but we really don't know very much. And there are still people who think this is going to be somehow connected to Mask of the Phantasm in any way, or Mr. Freeze. I still stand that I don't think Mr. Freeze makes any sense in this universe whatsoever. But the fact that there was a time when we didn't think the Batman Part 2 was going to happen, that it was going to be folded into the DC universe, the movie is being made. I don't think that it's going to become part of the DC universe. I love the idea, and this has been something that has never happened, where we could actually have multiple Batman running at the same time. We couldn't do it with Superman until we finally did it with Superman and Lois. And then eventually Zack Snyder's Justice League came out. And then we got David Cornsweet. It's unfortunate that they didn't run at the exact same time, but we got a small screen Superman, which was something where the rights have gone back and forth all the time. We've never truly had a small screen Batman until the very end of Gotham, but I didn't like Gotham. Andy, I know you did, but we're not going to have a conversation about that right now because, unfortunately, Andy, you're not here doing the news with me this week. I'm just happy this movie exists because I definitely think there's a possibility, given all the time that Matt Reeves had to do this, this being his second go with Batman, with Robert Pattinson, somebody outside of him, every single actor who has read this script is absolutely in love with it. Colin Farrell confirmed he's only in two scenes, and that's okay. Going from the Batman to the Penguin to the Batman Part 2, Colin Farrell has put himself on the Mount Rushmore of Batman villains. I don't think that is a crazy thing to say, given the run he's had as that character. I'm okay if it was one scene. I'm glad it's two, and I'm very curious, and I'm very excited to seeing what we get from Matt Reeves as the Batman Part 2. Is there a possibility it's better than The Dark Knight? That's going to be an argument of semantics, because I think The Batman already is the better Batman movie, and The Dark Knight is the best movie that has Batman in it. Those are technicalities, but I'm going to be sticking to them. The other piece of movie news before I jump into a piece of TV news is 24 Jump Street's finally happening. This is awesome. What Phil Lord and Chris Miller did with those two sequels, bringing them into live action, and obviously I loved Project Hail Mary, but the Jump Street films redefined buddy comedy in only the meta way that you can get from those two actors. The pairing of Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum is something that only comes around really once in a generation. You get your Steve Martin and your, oh my goodness, I'm forgetting the name of the other guy. Martin Short. Jeez, I have this. One name is the same, Kyle. How did you forget that? Or you got Martin Lawrence and Will Smith in Bad Boys. I love the Jump Street movies. I think 21 Jump Street was awesome. 22 Jump Street is one of the best, if not the best, comedy sequel of all time. And it ending with all of the other Jump Streets was so genius because it did kind of put them in a bind as to what they could do for the sequel. I'm sad that the crossover with Men in Black never happened, because from everybody we've heard talk about what that movie could have been, Channing Tatum said it was one of the best scripts he'd ever read. And I'm annoyed that movie never happened. But thankfully, finally on June 10th, 2026, we were given the confirmation that 24 Jump Street is in the works. Jonah Hill, Tatum, and Ice Cube in talks to return. Phil Lord, Chris Miller, and Neil Moritz are producing it. And that's okay because Rodney Rothman, who is going to be also writing the script, is directing it. And if you're thinking to yourself, who is Rodney Rothman? Well, he worked on the script for 22 Jump Street. He also directed and co-wrote Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. This is somebody who plays in the Phil Lord and Chris Miller world. I feel confident that this will be wildly entertaining, regardless of the fact that maybe both of them sort of want an easy win. I'm sure they are going to be being paid out the nose for this movie. That's okay with me. If this manages to cap off this Jump Street trilogy in a way we don't suspect, I don't think I can assume or suspect anything from this. A comedy sequel is often incredibly disappointing, and the fact that we've already gotten one and we've had this long wait to this film, 12 years since 22 Jump Street, what is this going to be? I can think of so many different possibilities, but I'm probably going to be wrong. I love that this is finally happening. Sony needs a movie like this because, let's face it, they're Sony. They made Morbius and Madame Web and Kraven the Hunter. Are you excited for 24 Jump Street? Let me know in the comments below this video. And finally, I love Doctor Who. I am a Whovian. I am incredibly mad, frustrated, sad. I'm so many different emotions. First off, I think Doctor Who has been consistently inconsistent since Series 6 with Matt Smith, the first of his seasons to sort of be split in half in a way that I thankfully never watched it that way. No, I did. I'm getting confused. No, 5 I watched all at once. But Series 6 and onward has been a mixed bag. And I am not going to be one of those people who stands and says, when it became woke, it became bad. There is just as much good and bad with every Doctor. It was probably the most consistent through Series 5, and then things obviously changed with Matt Smith, Capaldi, and everybody else who took on the role. I have loved every actor's certain touches that they have brought to the role of the Doctor. I had so hoped that Shuti Gatwa on Disney Plus was going to be a rocket into the stratosphere, putting Doctor Who on a level that we all knew it could get to, but it had never been before. Internationally, Doctor Who on Disney Plus and springboarding off of the 60th anniversary specials that were the perfect amalgamation of what we loved about the early era Tenet stuff, but with budgets and exploring sort of the ending of that version of the Doctor, getting David Tennant to play a much more emotionally awakened Doctor, somebody more in tune with those feelings, and getting to sort of close the book on a generation of the Doctor and maybe even the Doctor Who fans and go into the future with someone unlike any other Doctor we've had before. Shuti Gatwa is, of course, an absolute superstar, but as is the case, you have people who are ready and willing to hate on anything that is remotely different from the thing that they grew up with, which was just funny given if you'd ever paid attention to anything that Russell T. Davies ever made with Doctor Who. But it didn't explode the way that I think the BBC or Disney Plus was hoping, which led to only 2 seasons with Shuti Gatwa, a rushed regeneration into Billy Piper. And Russell T. Davies confirmed with everybody that he thinks, that they never came up with what the solution to that was going to be. It's more annoying than anything that that was the case. Most of us Doctor Who fans who felt relatively plugged in understood that it was a Hail Mary because you're getting people who loved the first revival series back in 2005 to be invested in Doctor Who again, which is fine with me if it came to sort of a conclusion that potentially, and this of course would have been tragic to some degree, that the bi generation is not sustainable. It was this long rumored thing, but the two Doctors would reunite. You would quite literally have Billy Piper uniting with David Tennant to give us the new Doctor. And that never came to pass. It would have been an awesome opportunity to sort of have a Doctor Who TV movie in a way that separates it from the Doctor Who Christmas specials. And Stephen Moffat himself said Doctor Who Christmas specials are one of the foundations of UK culture, and we're not getting that. It is okay that Doctor Who is going to take a break, because I do think Doctor Who needed to take a break. I was hoping that leading to what was supposed to be the production of this Christmas special, that you would cast an unknown actor and you would be given the chance, similar to Stephen Moffat leading into Series 5, who was given an entire year to get that season together, to write those scripts and really reboot the show within the show. And if the plan is to springboard into a new era with potentially a new studio being involved with BBC, that's okay. I don't hate the idea of Doctor Who sort of taking a nap. I don't love it. I love the show so much, and I will watch it for as long as I can. But I was really looking forward to getting to see Billy Piper's take on whatever that story was going to be, but we didn't get it. And this is the first time in my Whovian fandom career where there's going to be a break like this. I've watched it all the way through. It's been 21 years. And that's frustrating to have your fandom be toyed with in a way. I wish there was more some blunt honesty. I think fans are much more appreciative of that than being toyed with, which is sort of how it feels right now. But Stephen Moffat himself said, and Russell T. Davies said, Doctor Who's not canceled. It's just preparing for the future. And that's okay, as long as the future is bright and we get to see our favorite Time Lord back. Whether it be 20, 30, 4 years can feel like a long time, but I've waited longer between other series I love, and I will be there when Doctor Who hits the airwaves again, whenever then is. That will do it for movie and TV news of the week, and now it's time to respond to some listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I've been meaning to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, what is your favorite Steven Spielberg film? Sean Kippy Dalglish says, I really liked Ready Player One. I'm going to assume, Sean, that you read the book, because most of the people I've talked to that read the book seem to really like the movie. I thought it was fine. Tuca Chinchilla says Raiders of the Lost Ark. Seb says Disclosure Day is trash. Overrated AF director. I think that's an interesting answer to what is your favorite Steven Spielberg film, but okay. Nem6Ben, Jaws, Metal Monster. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is the only answer. If you say Saving Private Ryan, I'll give you that. Draz says Disclosure Day. And then Ray Bonilla says War of the Worlds. Jillian C.A., I can't choose. I'll go and see Disclosure Day first, then I'll weigh in. All right, go ahead. You're welcome to do that, Jillian. Scotty Cameron, I was surprised that I wasn't the only one to say Mask, but then again, with Image Comics Mask comic selling out before release, I shouldn't be surprised. I doubt DC Mask's run from the 1980s got a second printing before issues were released. On to his favorite Steven Spielberg film. Might be Raiders of the Lost Ark or The Last Crusade. I think his best might be Schindler's List. However, the movie is super depressing. It's hard to rewatch. Yeah, that's fair, Scotty. Whereas Indiana Jones is entertaining and fun. Affectionate Crazing Cows says Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. R1 Derp, sell. David says Jaws set the stage for today's thrillers. Dylan Pollock writes in, there's no wrong answer on favorite Spielberg films. Dylan, I disagree. There's a couple in there I think you could probably say aren't great. I guess I'd say either Jurassic Park or Jaws, but they're all good. Yeah, they're probably all good, but not all of Steven Spielberg's babies are created equal. Next week's review is going to be of Toy Story 5. This is a film that I know a certain amount of people are very nervous about, because they may have seen Toy Story 4, they may have seen Toy Story 4, and they're very nervous because we keep going back to the Toy Story universe. I get it. I absolutely adore Toy Story 3. It's the best third movie ever made, but it is, of course, the inspiration for this week's question of the week, which is, what is your favorite Toy Story? There's four of them, and I think people think this is an easy answer, but I think it's harder than you might suspect. To let me know, you can comment below. You can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com, or you can @filmrealist on any of the social medias. Just make sure to include the hashtag QOTW. If you're watching this on YouTube, please like the video. Please subscribe to the channel. It helps the podcast get into more people's algorithms and allows the podcast the opportunity to grow. If you're just enjoying it yourself, please give a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform. Make sure you don't miss next week's episode, which, as I said, is Toy Story 5. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Kyle Naranja, and I will see you next time.